The Gambling Files Podcast, sponsored by those wonderful people at Sporting Tech.
Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files Podcast. I am one of your hosts, John Bruford. Yes, I said one of your hosts because we have a special surprise this episode, maybe next episode as well. I can't remember when his holidays are, but we're joined by industry celebrity, top sexologist, James Bennett. James, welcome.
Well, thank you, John. I've never been described as one of those things, or either of them, actually. But thank you for having me on.
I have a friend who's has been described many times in national press as a sexpert.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah, imagine that. Imagine how proud his parents
are. Or...
And other top quality red topped publications. And what can I say? He's also I've also seen him described as Mr. Sex, which is anyway.
Who is this guy?
It's Al Needham, host of other top podcast that the name of which has completely gone out of my head. Shit.
He's going to have a good podcast title as a sexpert, no?
Well, no, that's not what his podcast's about. His podcast is like, it's in the top one or two podcasts in its field. I'm going to have to find it now.
But is he big in Egypt?
I think we're probably bigger in Tanzania than he is.
Okay.
We've had several listeners there. Chart Music, that's what it's called. It's the Top of the Pops podcast. And it is Al and a couple of his mates, basically, watching old episodes of Top of the Pops and then talking about them. For listeners outside the UK, Top of the Pops is the old chart countdown show, you know, the top 40 of your popular music, and they watch old episodes of that and just reminisce and talk shit. And certainly for a while, it was the number one music podcast in the UK.
Wow. It's pretty cool.
I know, right?
Very cool.
Yeah. But there,
especially somebody... Go on.
Sorry, James. No, James.
I was going to say, especially is that, you know, there's repeats on constantly, isn't there? Top of the Pops. It's always on somewhere.
It's just fuel for their fire. I had a message from somebody saying, like, you know, love the podcast, but fuck me, 2 hours. And Al's is like 3-4 hours some weeks. You know, they just go for it, and people listen to it in chunks. But it's his living as well. So I mean, it must be bloody good. He's a very funny man. So anybody wanting to, you know, kill a bit of time, listen to some UK chart-based shenanigans, Chart Music. But interestingly, Chart Music is not sponsored by Sporting Tech, which this podcast is, which I think probably suggests a much greater sexual prowess in the Gambling Files podcast, thanks to our Viagra-touting buddies at Sporting Tech. James, how do you feel about iGaming platforms?
There are many of them, and it's very difficult to figure out which ones are best. But obviously, as Sporting Tech is, you know, are sponsoring this, then I'm guessing they must be the best.
I think they're certainly in the top two. But, you know, we have no opinion. This is a reportage, really. What we're doing here, it's reportage. It is the best description. Or sabotage, maybe. So, James, you, when we first met, right, obviously quite a while ago, you were right-hand man to top marketing dude Luke Davis at Playtech.
I was indeed, correctly. Yes.
The legendary Luke Davis. Now, when I was thinking back about this, I remembered a story about Luke, although it's a story about me being a dick and Luke reminding me of what a dick I am. So we were we were at a gambling awards event some years ago, and I've probably pissed and moaned about this event before on this. The event will remain unnamed, but we've gone along to it, champagne reception, wine on the table, and then they didn't serve dinner until it was like 10:15, 10:30. Well, I wasn't the only shit-faced person in the room by that time. I was absolutely battered, not least because I drank all the wine on our table. The table next to me was empty, but it had wine on it, so I had their wine as well. So I was quite drunk by this time. I stole Paul Ryder's Blackberry. This is how long ago it was. Forgot that I'd stolen it, and it was in my pocket the whole time. Helped him look for it. Paul then went back to the hotel, searched his room in the hotel, got the taxi company to send the same taxi driver back, paid the taxi driver, searched the car, searched the taxi, got the taxi driver to take him back to the hotel where the event was, searched the room again, spent all of the next day on the phone trying to sort out his BlackBerry, because he was due to go to Orlando a couple of days later for another event. And when he was on his way to the airport, I was packing my stuff in my room, and there's Paul's BlackBerry underneath my dirty clothes. I phoned him up and I said, "You'll never guess what I found." Oh, God, you should have heard what he called me. But that is not the story. So after the event, when I'm utterly hammered, we go downstairs into the basement bar of this hotel, which shall remain nameless because it may be, I don't know, maybe somebody will know what I'm talking about. And it's kind of, things get a bit blurry for me after that. I see Luke the next day and he's going, "You okay, John?" "Yeah, why?" "You had a few to drink last night." "Yeah, were we talking?" "Yeah, yes, we were." He said, "And we were downstairs in the bar after the event, and you were introducing everybody, but you didn't know any of them." So apparently, I was going, you in the shirt, come over here. You got to meet this guy. You, what's your name? Meet. Look at this guy. Look at his shirt. It's blue." And on from there. And I went around the whole room and did it, introduced everybody. So, yeah, me being a dick and Luke finding it amusing. So there you go.
Was that the day you quit drinking?
No, that was in the doctor's office. That was the doctor saying, you have gout, and me saying, "Oh, how do I not get that anymore?" And she's like, "Well, quitting drinking will help." Brilliant. I'll do it. Gout is hideous. A truly, truly awful, awful pain. And one of the things, right, blokes piss and moan about gout, right? And you know, I get it. And it can cause permanent joint, well, it does cause permanent joint damage, and it can spread to any joint in the body, et cetera, et cetera. But I saw somebody posit a question on a gout forum online, and they said, seriously, man, there's loads of them. And they all have the same
gout forum.
There's stacks of them. But they all have people asking the same questions in them, which is, basically, I had some beers at the weekend, and now I'm having an awful attack of gout. What do you all drink in order to not get attacks? Like, I don't drink fucking alcohol, basically. That helps. But anyway, so I'm on this gout, and somebody puts a question out, because it's far more common in men than women. Somebody puts a question out there. I've heard that it's worse than childbirth, but obviously most of us are men. We have no frame of reference. Are there any women sufferers in the room who can say whether it is or not? And a woman came back and said, "Just to put that one to bed forever, I would much rather have more children than have gout again." yeah, it's hideous. So yeah, stop drinking. Whew. But as I found out then, it's not drinking that made me fat. James, right. So you went from there to somewhere else. Did you go from there to Square in the Air?
I did indeed. I went back to Square in the Air for about 3.5 years.
can say, yeah, you're at Square in the S quite a while.
Mm-hmm. And built up the B2B business there, which is doing very well.
Definitely grew in personnel under your, you know, BD watch. I'm not saying that you got BD eyes.
With the help of a very good team, obviously. And then, you know, most of the guys are still there and it's growing even more. Now I think they're expanding into the States and they've got a new brand out there, which is something we always wanted to do. So it's good to see that's doing well. And then
what's the American office called? Is it like Hole in the Ground? Is that like a complimentary brand?
I think they've called it Chalk and Dog, but I'm not going to promote their stuff today. But I think they've done a joint venture with another agency out there.
But it's a shit name. I mean, I'm not dissing them when I say this. It's like we've run out of decent brand names. So I buy this probiotic stuff for my dog so that he doesn't produce rivers of shit in the living room anymore. And it's like it's dry probiotic powder. He goes nuts for it. He goes absolutely mad for it. It's called Pooch and Mutt. Wow. Like they're different things. I mean, you could argue that a pooch is a regular dog, a mutt is a mongrel. But fundamentally, we're talking about both dogs. And I just hate it. One of my least favorites is actually, I'm a customer of, I buy my razor blades from a company called The Bearded Colonel. Emailed them and tweeted them to say, could somebody please give me an idea as to why I'm buying razor blades off somebody with a fucking beard? And nobody has yet come back to me.
Surely it's not as bad as, you know, other sort of dog related treats, right? So you've got the Woofin, which is a dog muffin.
Done.
You know, we've gone right, forever.
It's up there with fucking banoffee. I hate that. I hate those words. But, you know, as somebody pointed out, you've got words like podcast and, you know.
You can get doggy wine, can't you, these days? You can get doggy all sorts. Posh pooch wine, whatever it's called.
Well, I've completely changed how my dog eats because, well, apart from the rivers of shit that were coming out of him. But I've been looking at dog food for years and thinking, I do not understand why dog food is composed the way it is. And my ex phone, she heard me talking to a vet a few months ago. She's like, did I just hear you telling the vet how to vet? I'm like, you may have heard exactly that, yes. Well, the thing is, right, so the dog had really bad diarrhea for several months. He was really well in himself, but there was obviously something he was eating that was just really disagreeing. And the vet's like, oh, keep him on chicken and rice. Well, it turns out chicken and rice is a big part of the problem. But so the vet's like, try this hydrolyzed protein, right? Are you familiar with that expression?
I'm not, but I've got a dog and she had, you know, the squirts for a long time, not 3 months because probably would have killed her. But we had to feed her some sort of fiber. Yeah, it was like all bran, but super all bran.
Oh, God.
I didn't try it, honestly, but it looked disgusting. Yeah. But she was fine after about 2 weeks or something.
Do you know all bran has loads of sugar in? Can you imagine how bad it would taste without sugar? Jesus.
Like dog fiber, yeah.
So, like, he's yeah, so the vet says, we've got this hydrolyzed protein. And I said to her, you wouldn't happen to sell it by any chance, would you? And she said, well, yeah, actually we do. I'm like, really, what are the odds? Why should he have that? She's like, well, it's protein that's already been broken down, so it's an easier thing to digest. I'm like, right. What's the protein source? And she went, it's soya. I'm like, I'm not going to buy that for the dog. If you can show me a dog hunting soya in the wild, then I'm in. But until that day, I'm not going to buy soya for the dog to eat. Because if the protein is soya, where the fuck is the fat content from? Doesn't make any sense at all. That's a lot more shit to put in. So I've actually switched into a very, very high protein diet. And he's absolutely thriving on it.
Well, there you go. You totally miss your calling. You should be out there looking after small animals.
He's massive. He is really big. He's almost like, well, he's heavier than any of the kids. In fact, he's probably about the same weight as the three kids combined. But he's yeah, he's genuinely thriving on it. He looks great. He's got loads of energy. He's not producing rivers of shit anymore. So like, it does feel like a winner. But vets have to train for a long time. So I need to like be like a black market vet.
Yeah, that's right. Well, accelerated veterinary skills. I don't know, somewhere.
No, no, they really have to fucking train. I mean, like, it's like 8-9 years. They train much longer than a GP does, than like, you know, your standard family doctor, much longer. And they're probably really, really poor when they finish, but then really wealthy by the time they finish working, I would have thought. But anyway, how do we get onto this?
I'm not sure.
We were talking about your work, and we've wound up talking about my dogs.
I think it's much more interesting talking about rivers of shit and sort of, you know, bizarre dog treats. But yeah, so
Where do you work now?
Yeah, so we went from Playtech to Square in the Air, who I previously worked for before, from 2013 to 14, and then I went to Playtech, back to Square in the Air, and now I left Square in the Air at the end of last year to join an agency called Receptional. So they're based in Bedford, which not many people have heard of, probably.
I'm just racking my own brain. So Bedford? What's in Bedford?
Yeah. We'll get on to that, shall we, in a sec?
Well, yeah.
In Bedford?
Sorry, we can come back to Bedford. But
always time to come back to Bedford.
We had a guest lined up, right? Who I think might be on next week's now. So while you're our guest presenter, you're Fintan for the day. And so I'm sorry about that. Obviously minus some of the many benefits. Like all that hair. Have you seen how much hair he's got?
He does have a lot of hair, and it changes kind of every time I see him.
Well, he's got accessories for his hair, hasn't he? So I think, if I had that much hair, I'd probably accessorize as well.
I mean, we do have the wig awards, right? Obviously, they are women in gaming, but I actually probably do think we should have wig awards, and Finta would win a lot of awards based on that.
I like it. That's got legs.
Yeah.
But we could call it wigs in gaming. So it's like the wig, you know, you get where it comes from. So our guest, one of our two guests. So I recorded the first interview last Friday with Paul. Do you know Paul?
Paul Ryder?
No, not Paul Ryder. I wouldn't interview Paul Ryder. Christ. Come on.
I think you did, didn't you, a couple of months ago?
I did. I'm not going back there. Paul from Crucial Compliance, do you know him?
I don't know him, no.
Well, he's a lovely fella. And he's on this episode, and he's talking about the shit list that Gibraltar is now on, that Malta isn't on anymore, and what that actually means, and how and why and all of that, because he's also the CEO of the like sort of gaming companies thing in Gibraltar. So, like, he's top man there.
Sounds interesting.
I hope it is. Because if it isn't, a lot of people are going to be, you know, hanging up. So we got him on. We did have somebody else on, but, like, we're shit out of guests now. So we're going to interview you instead. Have you got any questions for you?
Bottom of the barrel. Any questions for me?
I said we're not having Paul Ryder back on. That is the bottom of the barrel.
Okay, second bottom. I'll take it.
Yeah, you know I mean, it's better than last. Receptional's like it's quite a fancy company name, isn't it?
It is an odd name. Yeah, it's an odd name. But then there's lots of other odd names in this industry, isn't there? So, well, they've been going for about 20 years, so probably longer than most gambling companies, I would have thought.
Was it founded by somebody called Al, or is that just me wishing that there was somebody called Al?
It was founded 20 years ago, and they weren't really involved in this area at all. They were kind of a very niche kind of search agency, search business, and it kind of built up over time. And you know, gaming and finance just become a focus of the business over the last 10 plus years, probably. And they've built up loads of different services. So it's a digital marketing business first and foremost. That's how it started, SEO driven, And then over the years, it kind of built up lots of other services. So link building, paid search, paid social, content. And then over the last year, we've added digital PR and creative. So it's the kind of, you know, we like to say we're the only end-to-end or only sort of complete digital marketing, digital PR agency in gaming, which is extraordinarily niche. But lots of people probably have never heard of us, but that's because, you know, we've not been particularly good at promoting ourselves, I think, over the last few years. So
oh,
I've come
the irony.
With that. The irony, yeah. So yeah, coming to help with that. And they've been working in gaming with lots of big names for the last 10 years. So the likes of Sky and Betfair and Paddy Power and BetDak, Casumo, you know, a lot of brands. And we've started to sort of, you know, we're on the map now, really. And we need to keep pushing and keep growing. And, you know, the agency's doubled in size over the last 18 months. So we're about 55 people now. So it's really a question of, you know, pushing as hard as we can. We know the next 12 months is going to be tough for everyone, right? But yeah, we need to compete with the other agencies and offer something completely different, which I think we do.
Well, it's a hell of a pitch.
Well, that's the idea, right?
I mean, it's what you do. Well, not you necessarily, yeah. But you know, it's what you do as a company.
But some,
a lot of buzzwords in there.
Tons of them. Even though I hate buzzwords, I've just probably spouted a million of them.
There were a few. I mean, I'm not judging you, you know, about your buzzword usage. There were a lot. Buzzwords are like, they're only buzzwords for a little while, and then they become part of the language, don't they? They go back down into, you know, your average bog standard until somebody comes up with another buzzy sound. So, like, what's your title at Receptional?
I'm PR director.
Okay. So what do you actually do?
So we've got a relatively small PR team here, but I'm trying to grow the PR side of the business, and that's my main focus, right? So that's across B2C, B2B, and then we're developing this kind of hybrid model. There's another buzzword between sort of link building and PR. So I can go into that in more depth if you like, but I guess on the surface, hybrid model is kind of the link building side, which is effectively going out and building links and buying links almost, and then attaching that earned side of PR alongside it. So you've got the sort of guaranteed stuff and then the earned stuff. So the guaranteed links and then the earned campaigns. The guaranteed links will give you the kind of lower domain rated links, and that the kind of earned PR, the more creative side, those sort of bigger campaigns will get you the premium and those super links, which the kind of money can't buy. Backlinks, right? I mean, really, a lot of this stuff is talking of Fintan is his bread and butter. So it's the link on, especially on the link building side. That's what they do day in, day out. That's why, you know, a lot of these affiliate companies are so big and so valuable. But the brands that I mentioned invest quite heavily in link building. And if you marry that with PR, then you can, you know, get up those up the rankings and get into the top three.
I get a lot of SEO junk mail, and I reply to some of it because it makes me laugh. But I wouldn't if I wasn't such a quick typist. But I'll get this stuff and they'll say, "Oh, we can get you on the first page for Google rankings," and I'm like, "How? we're in the gambling industry. How are we going to do that?" Not a chance. Although I appreciate that there are things everybody can do to improve their SEO, right? I mean, it's just some really basic shit that a lot of people aren't doing. But is there a tip that you can give anybody listening? Say, you know, are you doing this?
Good question. Look, I'm not an SEO expert, and that's
what?
Kind of what I'm not myself. But we have tons of experts here that
could you
work
phone
on
them?
That.
Can you phone him now?
Can I phone him in now? I want me to dial him in.
No, I'm just kidding. But you could text them and get a tip while we're talking.
Could do. Could do. I think you'd be surprised, though, from the stuff I've seen. You know, a lot of brands don't do the basics, like you said.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we're here to help. The tip, the advice is, you know, give us a call and we'll sit down and we'll make a difference. I think, you know, that's the thing. And the thing with all the services that I've explained, right, they're all completely measurable, whereas a lot of sort of traditional PR stuff isn't as measurable. At least it's very much brand awareness led. This is stuff that'll get you results and get you more money.
Yeah,
drive those revenues.
For a lot of companies, you know, will have either a very small or a non-existent marketing team, and it's kind of, for some companies, it's as valuable, and do stop me if I'm wrong or talking out of my ass, but it's as valuable to engage a company such as yours, to even if it's to just clarify what they actually want to achieve online. Because an awful lot of people got a website, it's fine, it's not something that's going to change a lot, doesn't have anything that's updated regularly, blah, blah, blah. But what's the actual aim of the website? What is its function? You know, because, yeah, somebody's going to come along to your website if they say they picked up a business card at an expo. What you want them to know that you didn't tell them at the expo? Probably not that much. What's the purpose of the site? What are you actually fishing for out there? And where do you want people to go? What do you want them to learn? What's the actual goal of your marketing? What's the actual goal of your online presence? I think there's an awful lot of companies, especially small to medium, that don't necessarily think about that aspect before they start, you know, touting online. And we're getting press releases, and all the magazines are getting these press releases. Companies saying, oh, we've redesigned our website. Oh, have you? How interesting. I'll be sure to, you know, I got one the one day, and we nearly did this on the podcast, but didn't. And somebody had redesigned their logo, and they just changed the color of a fucking line on their logo. And they sent out a release about it. Well, I'll stop the press. We really need to get this on as our lead story. It's unreal.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, yeah, I think there's agencies can really, really help people to clarify their marketing thought and therefore their marketing spend.
Yeah, I mean, too many people just go into these things too quickly, and we're very much, we sit there and we'll take our time. We're not going to rush into anything. You know, we'll audit your site, tell you what we think. We'll give you an honest view. And if it's not working, we'll tell you. But then, yeah, I think so many agencies don't do that. So I think that's kind of what I like about these guys here.
So where do you live?
I live in Bedford, so it's pretty handy. I can walk to work.
Yeah, that's pretty good. But
it is good.
Where is Bedford?
So Bedford is in between two glamorous places, Luton and Milton Keynes.
Oof.
Both of which you probably wouldn't want to go to.
I've been to one of them many times. In fact, I've run through suburban Milton Keynes wearing just my underpants.
Ah.
Probably won't come as a particular shock. Yeah, I had some friends who lived in Milton Keynes for a long time. And one of them worked at Merlin, which became Tops, the place that does football stickers and all that. Yeah, it's a very strange place. Very, very strange place.
It's an odd place. I've got a terrible sense of direction anyway, but I can never find my way around Milton Keynes because it's just on some sort of weird grid system. Everything looks the same. Like, the grid system makes sense, right? That's logical. But when everything looks the same, and there's about a million roundabouts, I have no clue where I'm going.
Yeah, everybody always says, oh, it's really logical, it's grid. Once you get your head around it, yeah, but I don't want to get my head around it because I've got other things I'd like to use my brain for. Other than working out just a set of fucking roundabouts.
Yeah. And it's just full of big warehouses, and it's a, like, you know, it's a logistics kind of area.
There is a, there is a grim, like a really nice like outdoor shopping center. That was quite nice. I tell you what, I did the Milton Keynes Half Marathon quite a long time ago, probably about 14, 15 years ago. And it's actually one of the most picturesque half marathons I've ever done, which sounds totally bonkers. But whoever planned the route of that is a very, very canny race director.
There are quite a few nice lakes around there. I know the route you mean. Yeah, once you kind of, because it's kind of, there's quite a few villages, right? Older villages around it. Yep. And there are some nice parts. It's quite green, despite everything I've just said. It's quite nice and green. But yeah, so Bedford's right in the middle of it.
The weird thing about Milton Keynes is you're walking down suburban Milton Keynes and you realize, not such a big deal these days, but you realize that there are no TV aerials or satellite dishes.
Didn't know that.
The whole town, the whole suburban part of the town is fed by cable, and it's the only town in Britain where that's done, I think.
Good
fact. It's part of planning. So the houses have never had TV aerials or satellite dishes. And people are, oh, doesn't it look better? It's like, well, do you know what? I don't care. I actually don't care. Doesn't the skyline look better? No, it's still just houses. So yeah, it's hard to get excited. Hard to get excited. James. We sort of get experts on to, you know, be experts and talk about things that they're experts in. In your opinion, talking about the PR, the marketing side of the industry, are there common things that you see that people are not necessarily doing wrong, but that maybe a little bit misguided? Or is everything brilliant?
You mean on the industry side, like B2B side?
Yeah.
I think that's a pretty formulaic kind of approach a lot of the time. That's probably what they're missing. I think it's probably become too formulaic. I think you mentioned just then about logos and press releases, and too many people think a press release is the way to go. And I don't think there's enough creative kind of thinking around that. You know, when you think about platforms or games, or there's just very little cut through and there's very little difference, right? And I think that's just the standard opinion, isn't it, in the industry, that there's very little differentiation. But I think that also applies to PR, and there's nothing I see necessarily that makes a massive difference. So it's all a bit vanilla, and I think there needs to be a bit of a change. I don't have the answer. It is different for everybody, but yeah, I just find it very vanilla, and there's got to be a bit more creativity, a bit more creative thinking,
a bit more
cut through, and also a bit more kink, and probably not sexpert kink, I don't think, but a bit more, and also a bit more opinion, right? There's not much opinion. There's not many people who are willing to go on the record and say really interesting things that can make a difference, or to kind of put their head above the parapet a lot of the time. There's a few people right in the industry that I can think of. But yeah, it's a bit like, if you look on LinkedIn, and I look on it most days, you know, there's not many people there really sticking their neck out and saying kind of cool, interesting things that make me take note. There's a few, but not many.
No, I think that's very fair. And it's what's very interesting is that whenever you see thought leadership pieces, they're just saying the same old shit again.
Yeah, God.
And quite the opposite of thought leadership frequently.
It's kind of very vanilla thought, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, totally, totally. Just, you know, buzzwords, cliches, same old shit. Because I don't know. Maybe. We have had controversial conversations on this podcast occasionally. But it would be amazing. A big part of the casino industry, land-based side, has this, if it ain't broke, don't fix it attitude. And I swear, technology-wise, if we didn't have, on the land-based side, reservation gaming, in the US, we didn't have Native American casinos. that industry would just be back in the Stone Age. Because they've been such a driver for new technologies, for trying out new shit. I mean, there's two or three casinos that I can think of, particularly in California, that have been used as the test bed, some really shit hot technology to refine it, to improve it. And yeah, without those guys, you know, just going out and willing to try something. What? It can make us more efficient. Well, let's give it a go for 6 months. Without that attitude, yeah, we would be so far further behind than we presently are.
Yeah, I mean, some of the best thought leadership I've recently heard has come from tribal guys, actually. When I went to RGB Live, yeah, I don't know if you caught that session with two of the tribal leaders, I think. Certainly two of the tribal executives and a couple of the think tribes in California. And they're just so passionate, as you would think they would be, but the way they speak is just so much clearer and so much with so much more passion than anyone, because they've probably, you know, grown up with it, or they've been, you know, I know it's their livelihood, and you know that's not going to change, but yeah, the passion and the kind of energy they bring to their talks is so much better than anything I've heard probably in the last couple of years.
Sweet. So we've had Guardian journalist Rob Davis on the podcast a couple of times, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm a fan of Rob as a journalist. I don't know him on a personal level at all. I am a fan of him as a journalist. And I know he gets a lot of, there's a lot of negative speak about him in the gambling industry because he comes across very much as having an anti-gambling slant. When in fact, I would actually say it's more accurate to say that he has a anti-shitty business practices slant. I don't know. We've had him on the podcast, like I say, twice. I've never actually asked him if he has a personal issue with gambling. I've never asked him what his personal views on gambling are. But he's fundamentally a business journalist, and I would argue he's one of the more solid ones out there, and I really do think his work is largely excellent. Anyway, reading a story by Rob Davis in today's Guardian. No, hang on, yesterday's Observer, sorry. I was looking at it online. And I sent you the link to this earlier, right? UK will not ban video games loot boxes despite problem gambling findings, right? So this is an Observer story or a Guardian story about loot boxes in video games, which apparently have an association with problem gambling and developing it at a very young age in an unmonitored way of playing. People spend money unlocking game rewards, which are supposedly random, blah, blah, blah. But these are in some of the biggest games in the world. They're in the FIFA series, they're in Call of Duty. The story points out they're effectively banned in Belgium. But this is about the UK. So the UK's culture minister, Nadine Dorries, has said, and I fucking love
God, this. Yeah. God help us all.
She said the UK will not follow suit. So there will not be a ban on loot boxes in the UK now. I think as an industry, we can kind of get behind the idea that. So a lot of the quibble about this is it gambling? Is it actually gambling? Well, if it's leading to problematic gambling behaviors, I think we could probably argue that regardless of whether it could be properly defined as gambling, it still needs to be kicked into touch. Because you're just fucking splitting hairs at that point. But is it actually, well, fuck that. It's causing a problem. So let's deal with it. Let's not get into the semantics. Let's not fanny about and waste time with that. Let's just sort it out. So the government, this is beautiful. The government has had a 22-month consultation to look at loot boxes. And they've decided they don't know enough about it to do anything.
Yeah. Like most things this government's done, they've just kicked into touch, right? It makes the white paper look like a short exercise. But this one, yeah, they've had almost 2 years to look at this, and they've just kicked into touch and just pushed it back into the gaming industry's court and said, look, you need to start improving, you know, your platforms and your kind of protections for children and young people and adults as well. And then, and they've said that, I think reading from the story, they've said, look, we need to see tangible results. Otherwise then we'll legislate. But what are the results? This is all despite, I don't know who did the research, but they've proven to a certain extent that loot boxes can be an early sort of trigger, I suppose, if you use them enough or play them enough or open enough or whatever, for problem gambling from an early age.
But it's but despite that, all that in the story that they can't prove a causal link. Fair enough, because that would be definitive, wouldn't it?
Yeah, they can't prove it, but there is evidence there.
Yeah, totally.
That it can happen.
You know, it's fairly compelling, but it's not causal, and that's the problem. They can't say this is it definitively. So why stop? Why?
But I was thinking about this, right? They've banned bonus buy features on slots, right, in the UK?
Okay.
So, you know, spend £10 to kind of try and guarantee at least to get into the bonus. Well, you get into the bonus, but then potentially almost guarantee, in inverted commas, some kind of win. It's a similar thing to loot boxes, is it not? I mean, you're paying to open a box, which may or may not. The only difference, I suppose, is that you're opening a loot box doesn't give you any real money.
No, but
it feels almost like a very similar thing.
It is valuable shit that you buy because you can trade that. It is like currency. Like, you can trade skins, etc. So, yeah. I mean, it's not strictly speaking currency, but, you know, kind of is.
And then even worse, right? I noticed in the story that they said that certain games or sites or whatever do allow you to trade a loot box for raw money.
Yeah, that's, I mean, gambling. That's just mental now.
That's where that argument falls down, and that's where probably they should at least legislate that, put some form of legislation in to kind of prevent that from happening.
There's a brilliant quote from the government. This is fucking fantastic. It says legislation to impose curbs or prohibition on loot boxes as part of an expected overhaul of the UK's gambling laws could have, and I quote, unintended consequences, Dory said. Now, there's a government response to the consultation published in the early hours of Sunday morning, and I quote, for example, legislation to introduce an outright ban on children purchasing loot boxes could have the unintended effect of more children using adult accounts, thus having more limited parental oversight of their play and spending. Now, stop me if I'm wrong, but if a kid is using a grown-up's bank account to buy this, A, theft stroke fraud, B, quite importantly, there will be much greater parental oversight, not more limited. Because you show me a parent that doesn't see 80 quid going out of their bank account on some fucking Call of Duty tat, and I will show you a parent who is probably quite drunk. So I think that's a shitty cop-out excuse. And I'm not saying that our government in the UK is full of shitty cop-out excuses, but they are. They're full of shitty cop-out excuses, and they're a shit government, and I can't wait for them to fuck off. But anyway, I digress. So do you watch anything on Netflix, James?
I do. Yeah, I watch a few things.
What, like?
Ooh. You know, being a listener of this podcast, I'm going to be one of the exceptions and say that I've watched Cobra Kai.
Get in. But did you like it?
And yeah, I mean, I think it's probably the most binge-worthy thing that's been on telly for ages.
Well, yeah, but you're the exact right age for it as well. Late 20s.
That's it.
But you are. I mean, well, you and I are both the exact right age for Cobra Kai. Although I have heard of young people watching it. I haven't seen it yet with my own eyes, but I've heard it happen.
Anecdotally, I think a few of my son's schoolmates did try it, and then I don't think they carried on watching it.
They should probably start one of the episodes with fighting in.
Yeah.
Kids love a bit of that.
Yeah. But yeah, I thought it was great. I thought, you know, it's perfect kind of what are they, half an hour episodes or something? They're very short episodes, aren't they?
Yeah, 35, 36 minutes.
They're
not
2.5 hours long, like the last episode of Stranger Things. But
I still totally watched it. I had to go back and watch the last 10 minutes again because I did fall asleep. But I did thoroughly enjoy Series 4 of Stranger Things.
Yeah, I watched it in bits. You know, you sort of watched half an hour, 45 minutes, then leave it and then carry on.
Some weeks, you know, like you get so busy. I know, like, you've got a young family as well. That, like, so I have my kids every weekend, apart from the other weekend when I had a fucking car crash. So I have my kids every weekend. So if I'm going to work late, I tend to work late in the week. Fair enough. But I set a new record for being absolutely shit at watching stuff. It took me 4 nights to watch a 90-minute film. The thing is, it wasn't a bad film by any stretch of the imagination. I really enjoyed it. I just could not stay away. But 4 nights, that is pretty special. It took me 5 or 6 nights to watch that last Bond film.
But then I thought that was dreadful.
It wasn't good, was it? I mean,
I'm a Bond fan as well, and I started when Amazon put them all back on the they had most of them, I think, didn't they, on Amazon. I went through the older ones. I'm much more than I would a Bond fan.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, there's a couple of early Connery films, and I think particularly From Russia with Love is excellent. And partly, you know, as is so often the case, actors were very different in the late 60s, early 70s, in fact, through the 1980s as well. But you had many more of what are now described as character actors, which they just used to call actors. But if you look at From Russia with Love, I mean, Robert Shaw and Sean Connery, what a phenomenal pairing. And, you know, Donald Pleasance in a couple. I mean, even in some of the Roger Moore movies, you've got Yaphet Kotto playing opposite Roger Moore. These are top quality actors. And I think it's the quality of the opposition that has been something of a letdown in the last few decades. I'm going to pretend Pierce Brosnan never made a Bond film. But I thought Timothy Dalton's last one was excellent. License to Kill. I thought it was a really, very, very underrated movie. And, you know, a couple of Daniel Craigs have been excellent. But even the excellent ones have been 20 minutes too long. I kind of find that annoying because streaming TV now is allowing people to make series that aren't, in the case of America, 22 to 24 episodes. You know, in the UK, we're used to things being 6 episodes long. And it allows a story to be told in the amount of time the story needs to be told because we don't have these predefined seasons like a lot of other countries do. And that does affect the sort of format of storytelling. As bizarre as it sounds, I promise it's true. But streaming, like if you watch a lot of the episodic stuff on streaming, the episodes are all different lengths. And I love that. Because they're taking the amount of time it takes to tell that part of the story. And there's no flab on these things. Like, I just watched The Queen's Gambit. And I'm very, very late to that particular party. But it was really fantastic. Beautifully told. Just really, really nicely put together show. You know, just... It kind of had everything and it did everything really, really well.
And a totally different topic, well, right?
Yeah, fantastic.
Totally different subject matter, classy kind of, yeah, really beautifully shot, brilliantly acted, and actually, I'm not sure how they managed to sell that into the network.
It's not even like
service.
I mean, it's from a Walter Tevis book, and like I like Walter Tevis, but I wouldn't have gone to I never in my wildest dreams would I have said, hey, do you know what make a great TV show? You'd just be like, you've lost your mind. The elevator pitch must have been phenomenal. God, I'd love to have been on that meeting. But it was utterly compelling. And Yeah, it does not outstay its welcome. I think it's 7 episodes. What the hell else is 7 episodes? Nothing.
Yeah, it was excellent. And it knew when to stop, right? Whereas Stranger Things, it's just going to carry on, right, for the next season.
Yeah, next season's the last one.
Right. Whereas I think probably, well, look, who am I to say? Because millions of people absolutely love it. This season probably should have been the last, in my view, but I was expecting it to be the last.
Well, let's wait and see, because the final season might be awesome.
It could, but I'm sure it will be.
Even like really, really great shows, like I've probably got, let me think. Probably got 3 TV shows that probably rate above anything else, which you probably shouldn't ask me what they are, because you're probably going to think I'm a bit strange.
Give us a taste.
All-time favorite show is probably The Rockford Files.
Okay. Going back a few years.
Yeah, but it stands up really well, and it's a really unusual show. Because if you think of the sort of detective stuff that was on TV and in cinema at the time, it was all about who had the biggest gun. I'm not just talking Dirty Harry either. You very, very, very rarely see the main character use a gun. It's all about living by his wit. And therefore, it's a much more character-driven show, and it's tremendous. It's fantastic. Probably Friday Night Lights, that'd be up there. That's pretty damn special. And I think probably third on the list, and they're not in any particular order, I think Frasier.
That is good.
So Friday Night Lights had a weird thing where the story kind of flipped on, like, I think it was like the fourth season, where coach moved schools. That was bizarre, but it still kind of worked. Rockford Files did what it did, had some great peripheral characters, didn't really get tired, just kind of sailed into the sunset and then made some shitty TV movies. Frasier, I think, went 10 seasons, and it should have probably gone after 8. And that's a difficult thing to say, because it was still really good. But it's that thing of Frasier's really good is better than almost anything else's best day. But it's far below Frasier at its peak. And you watch it because you're hoping there's not going to be a shark jumping episode. There are still those moments that make you laugh your ass off. And you come back. And I think you can only have a couple of seasons of slightly slacker stuff before you really lose people. But but then the final season was very, very good.
It was excellent.
We're wandering, sorry. So anyway, listen to the podcast. It's here now, and it's a shorter episode. Oh, shit, do you know what? We might, I'm not sure. This is going to sound really silly. I'm not sure if we are going to do this or not. But we might have music on this episode for the first time.
Oh, what, intro music or music all the way through? Or
no, I'm going to do intro and outro music. Yeah.
What, original?
Kind of. I think I might have talked about this on the last episode. But I was at sixth form with a singer and musician, and she's quite brilliant, really unusual artist. And she owns all of her publishing, and I asked her if she would do something for us. And she's like, shit busy, and it is quite a big thing to ask of somebody. It's like me saying to somebody, somebody saying to me, could you spend a couple of days writing me something? And we're like, well, for free. Anyway, she said, no, I own my publishing, so if there's something I've already done that you fancy, give me a shout. So I did. And so I already have the files. We will have an instrumental version of Mara Carlisle's Boldface en Provence as the intro.
Wow, totally lost me there.
I might put the whole song on as the outro, but it'll be the instrumental version. It's beautiful.
What was the brief? I mean, what was the kind of?
Well, I just went through her back catalogue and just like picked a song I really, really liked. But I couldn't sort of pick the songs that I like the most personally because they were a little bit odd. Like this one, which is just her voice and her playing the saw. And the saw is quite, it sort of plays with quite odd frequencies. It's a bit of a head mash. And while I would have loved to have had that, it's called Saw Song. I thought, you know, maybe not. She did another one called Piani, which was used in an IKEA advert. And it's a gorgeous, gorgeous song. It's really, really slow. The intro is super slow and it's, you know, and you kind of think, are people going to die maybe while they're listening? So I went for Boldface on Provence. Because it's a little bit more upbeat. So maybe I'll have it on there, maybe I won't. Who knows? But either way, we're still sponsored by Sporting Tech, and that's what counts.
So you've got sponsorship now, you've got music, and what's left to kind of fill?
Well, we just got to see if Fintan's ever going to come back from Australia.
No, I don't think so. He'll stay there.
I think you might be right.
Why would you leave?
I've never been. Have you been?
I've been once, actually, and I went on a trip with, this is like, I used to work in the Middle East, and I used to get all these, lots of nice freebies. And I went with Audi on their last leg of, they do a month-long trip with their new cars across Australia, and I went on the last leg of their trip for a week. And it was like all expenses paid. You'd get to drive these super cars across the bush and across the outback. And you ended up driving up on a beach. Seeing the sunset, it was spectacular.
Wow.
Very lucky. Yeah, it was a lovely trip.
I was not.
I know nothing about cars, and I don't really write about cars, but they invited me, so I thought, okay, I'm going to go.
Yeah, I totally wasn't expecting you to come out with that.
No, it's really good.
I'm trying to think of my best press trips now.
And bizarrely, I don't know if you're into your football, aren't you? Lizarazu was on the trip, ex-French defender. Was on the trip with us. Just
didn't
randomly.
He retire to become a surfer?
Yeah, he was a bit of an odd guy. And I ended up walking around Sydney with him.
But he wasn't the only former professional footballer to retire to become a surfer either.
Right.
I'm pretty sure Albert Ferrer, who played right back for Chelsea, I'm pretty sure he did the exact same thing. She's like, maybe it's a right back thing. Oh, no, hang on. Was he left back or right back?
I'm not sure. He was a fullback. Let's just say it was a fullback thing because, yeah, it's a...
I'm trying to remember which side Turan played for the national side, though.
They're generally quite mad, aren't they?
I think it might
small,
be a right
angry
fullback.
And mad.
Nothing wrong with that. But that is pretty weird. I wonder if you bumped into him again, it'd be like, you know, we'll always have Sydney.
Hey. Yeah. I remember walking around Sydney with you and off-roading.
Yeah, it's quite a bonkers story. God, I've done nothing to compare with that. Sorry. Well, I saw Eminem play at a private party. That was pretty cool.
That would be good. I'd rather have that, I think.
It was not bad. He was pretty good. I can see why he's done well for himself.
Did you get to chat to him or?
I didn't. I met his best mate, who's now deader than shit. Got shot in the face after an argument in a bar in Detroit. But I tell you what, no word of a lie, and I'm not one to speak well of the dead just because they're dead. He was an absolutely lovely guy. And it was a real shock to sort of see, like, you know, because it wasn't even that long after. And he just, you know, apparently, an altercation in a bar and some dude shot him in the face.
Wow.
So, yeah, sad times. But, yeah, he's a really good
Them's
guy.
Them's the breaks, eh? That's a tough one.
Well, Detroit is... a bit rough, I think. I'm no expert, but yeah. When I was there, Jesus, forgot about this. When I was there, the PR folks who put the trip together, they were like, so I gather some of you are thinking about taking a hire car out. The advice from the police to visitors is don't stop at red lights. It's safer to drive through a red light than it is to stop the car. But yeah.
Is this the Nadine Dorris traffic guide?
I don't know how you can be so harsh about this government. They're trying their best.
I mean, this is the woman who what she called the she said it was a tennis pitch instead of a tennis court, and she mixed up rugby league and rugby union.
Yeah, which what I a knobhead.
The latter is a little bit easier to do, but still.
She probably doesn't even know that they're called tennis bats.
No, exactly.
Amateur.
Actually, she was the MP for Bedfordshire. There, I'll sneak that in, actually. I've totally forgotten about that.
Well, if you're going to sneak that in, I'm going to point out that Sporting Tech can provide all your iGaming platform needs. Enjoy the podcast.
We sashay like some kind of Latino dancer to our first guest. We're joined by Mr. Paul Forster. He is the CEO and founder of Crucial Compliance and CEO of the Gibraltar Betting and Gaming Association. Very important man. Paul, hello.
Hello and good morning, and thank you for the invite today.
That's okay. Now, Paul, is it reasonable to say you've never listened to this podcast?
Absolutely. I always find it better to come on podcasts that you've never listened to before.
You're
in for such a treat. Makes it more interesting.
You're not going to regret anything. Other than possibly being born at some point in the next 30 minutes. So, Paul, just to clarify one little thing, what does Crucial Compliance do?
Yeah, we're a compliance consultancy and software company that provides basically solutions to the industry, mainly around player protection and harm minimization for players.
Oh, we've had some like top experts on here.
Yeah, that's probably not me. I'm more to do with solutions.
But we've had like, you know, folks from the New York. We've had we've had some of the leading lights in responsible gambling. We've had Dr. Auer from Necton.
Indeed.
We've had we've had Judge Cheryl on.
Yep.
What a legend. What a fabulous human being she is. I'm such a fan. We've had them all, really, I think. Well, Meryl. Meryl's no, hang on. Is it Meryl? Have I just got her name wrong? Not your colleague. I'm not talking about your colleague, Meryl.
I was going to say, I've got a Meryl, but...
No, this is a different Meryl.
I don't know anybody called Meryl, but there's lots of people around there. Now, thankfully, there's a lot of people doing a lot of research and good work into responsible gaming and harm minimization, which we didn't have a few years ago. So there's a lot of experts popping up who've been quite quiet until now. So it's great to see.
Yeah, there's a lot of people working to just improve things, you know, and to understand fucking Meryl. That's why I said Meryl, because I'm talking to you. I meant Maris.
Maris, yeah, from Kindred.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's the guru.
Absolute superstar.
Yeah.
And, you know, with people like Maris working in the industry, you know we're going in the right direction.
Absolutely. And, you know, the more companies that can hire a Maris, if only you could clone her. In fact, I think I said that on a recent panel we sat on. If you could clone her and put her in several companies, it would be brilliant.
I'm a big fan. Well, the podcast is a big fan. So, you know, we've had all the big hitters. And now you. So I guess maybe we're running out of big hitters. I'm just kidding.
I'm big in size.
Paul, do you watch Netflix at all?
I do indeed.
Are you familiar with Cobra Kai?
I am. My children love it.
Your children love it?
Yeah.
How does that work? And what about you?
Yeah. Well, I have to watch it, but it's one of those things that's normally on in the background.
Wow. You're the first person that said that.
Yeah, well, you know, it all goes back to the original Karate Kid, doesn't it? You know,
well, presumably, if they're still kids now, they don't remember the original Karate Kid.
They don't at all, but I do, you see, so I just don't want to ruin it. It's got a special place in my heart, that original films. So with the exception of the recent Top Gun, which is far better, Maverick, I think you should leave the past in the past. And when you update it, do it properly. And I think Cobra Kai's done a great job of updating stuff.
It's a very, very clever concept. I mean, there's no getting around it. It's really, they've subverted the movies really very cleverly.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan. I usually have a co-host, Fintan, who is currently living his best life in Australia, usually living his worst life in Amsterdam, but he's living his best life in Australia for the next 5 weeks. And we were doing like a straw poll on the podcast to see just how many people were really watching Cobra Kai. And then the one day he just reveals he's never seen it. And I'm like, oh, fuck's sake,
It is one of those things that I didn't know anything about it till my kids said about it. I don't know how I'd missed all the PR and everything around it. And then when they put it on, you know, you kind of just sit there and watch it. And then you're like, all right, yeah, that links back to this and that's that. But I can't say I've sat down and watched it start to finish. I just catch it when it's on the TV with my children watching it.
Okay. Well, it's better than nothing, I suppose.
Hey, it's a lot worse on TV.
The main thing we wanted to talk to you about today, though, was that recent thing. So Gibraltar Betting and Gaming Association, of which you are the CEO, as we may have mentioned. But how can we put this? I'm just going to put it in the bleakest terms I possibly can. So Gibraltar's been shitlisted and Malta has been de-shitlisted. What's the name of the listing that you
It's in? FATF. So it's the grey listing of FATF, which is the task force on financial crimes across the world, especially the EU.
So who did you piss off to get on that?
Well, you see, every country that wants to go on the whitelist has to go through a review. And a few years ago, we had a review and they came up with about 74 things that we had to do to get on the whitelist. We managed to successfully do 72, but there were two that were still open and not completed. And it's those two things that they've decided warrant putting us on the grey list.
Well, that seems a little bit officious, doesn't it?
It's never been done like that before. It does seem a bit harsh, especially when, you know, it wasn't like they'd done nothing about this. You know, as an industry, we've done stuff. As a regulator, we've done stuff. And as a government, we've done stuff. So, yeah, it sat quite harsh on us that we got on the grey list as a result of that. Because, you know, no other country had ever gone on for two partially implemented considerations. The whole EU thing going on at the moment with Brexit, Gibraltar and Spain. And, you know, you just get a feeling that there's more to this than meets the eye.
Do you ever think that maybe it's just that Jesus hates you?
Well, somebody hates us. I think it's, just everybody wants to live in the sun, and because they can't, they get really upset.
But is the timing of Malta's re-emergence from the shit list coincidental, or did they just kill the right journalist this time?
So what happens is they take a vote every year on who comes off and who goes on. So it was just the timing of it that they were coming off as we were going on. We don't know the criteria for why Malta was on the grey list. We don't know the criteria how they got off the grey list because it's not made public. So the two things are not interlinked other than we were at the same meeting and reviewed for them to come off and us to come on.
Crikey.
Yeah. So it doesn't look great in the world's stage, or, you know, the timing could have been better, but that's just the way that system works.
But what does it realistically mean for Gibraltar and all those Gibraltar license holding companies?
So in reality, it just means that we've got 12 months to solve the problems that need doing. And if they do that, then pretty much it's done and dusted like Malta did. In reality, how does it hit you? You know, if you have a company in Gibraltar, when you go for anything from a bank account anywhere else in the world to, you know, applying for credit, etc., it will come up that you are in a country that's got a slightly higher risk. It's all to do with financial risk ratings. And being on a grey list will increase your financial risk rating at source. So that's the only place it really affects gambling and gaming, because, you know, we're fully regulated. It's not like we're a non-regulated organizations here in Gibraltar who are going to be hit massively by being on a grey list. We're all fully regulated all around the world and compliant with the requirements. So in reality, the impact will be minimum.
So kind of a whole lot of sort of hot air and thunder and not much lightning.
Yeah, it's more to do with the government perception. So if you have government debt, it's not great. But of course, we're not a state that has government debt. You know, we're not on the, you know, we don't sell bonds or anything like that. So our government debt rating doesn't really change. So the likes of Malta, you know, there was much more of an impact than Gibraltar, because we're just a rock at the end of the Iberian Peninsula, really. So in terms of gaming and gambling, it won't have that much effect on us as long as we get off the list in 12 months' time, I think it's fair to say.
I once heard somebody describe Gibraltar as a large rock with lots of masturbating monkeys on it. And I think they were talking about simians.
they were talking about the macaque. So there's lots of YouTube videos because they are wild creatures and they do wild things. And so, you know, with the amount of tourists we get here, there is often videos of the macaques up the rock helping themselves to a bit of enjoyment.
Wow. I guess I just wanted to check that they were actual monkeys and not, you know, cheeky monkeys kind of thing.
Yeah, there's over 300 of them, about 336, and they're all wild. So they're wild macaques that roam the upper rock and love it when tourists come who they can basically steal all the food off. So they don't have to eat the healthy food we give them. They really do prefer things like chocolate bars, ice creams, and sandwiches off cruise ships.
Hmm. That's probably fair. So, wow. I was expecting some kind of highfalutin tale of corruption on the high seas kind of thing. I wasn't expecting that. Yeah, there's a couple of things we didn't do. It'd be sorted next year.
Yeah, like you say, it was down to a couple of things. The one that affected gambling was they said that there basically wasn't enough enforcement action taken because they forget that Gibraltar only has a few licenses. So, you know, unlike, you know, Malta or the UK with over 300 licensees, we've got like 18 B2C licenses here. So five companies have been done for, you know, failure to correctly implement money laundering regulations, fined between them over £3 million. So, you know, five out of 18 companies is pretty huge. So, you know, and to be honest, you can't find companies that are doing it right. It's a legal requirement. If you follow in the law, you can't be fined. So this is where my brain goes to, which is, well, if nobody else was failed, and they didn't say anybody else had failed, then how can you do us for not finding more companies when it's a legal process to follow? It's just bizarre. It's like saying, you know, you didn't put the insurance premiums up for everybody in Gibraltar when nobody had accidents. Well, of course you didn't. You know, so yeah, and that was the reality of the situation, and that's how it affected gambling. So the regulator had done his job, you know, and had done a very good job, and those companies that got caught out paid the fines, and it was made public. Even better, that money went to fund the Centre of Excellence in Responsible Gaming at the university. So all that money was put into research into problem gambling and gambling-related harm. So when you think about it, it's like the right thing to have done. But for some reason, somebody somewhere in some bureaucracy decided that we hadn't done it right or not enough of it. And that's the tale. And because of the nature of these organizations, you know, they're very secretive, so you never get to the bottom of why.
Yeah, that doesn't really help, does it?
No. It doesn't, and then you can have all the thoughts about was this political, and you know Gibraltar has been a very successful gaming space for many years, has successfully argued against many European countries based on you know EU legislation and used it to our advantage. So you know, was there a bit of kickback on that? Who knows? You know, the conspiracy theorists out there will always come up with reasoning, but the fact is we just don't know. And that's why there is no great story behind it. It's they made a decision. We don't really understand why. They told us why, but it doesn't make sense. And there's no real right of appeal, so we've got 12 months to solve it. So we're just getting on and doing it, which is why it's gone really quiet. Everybody's just like, yeah, fine, we'll deal with it.
Well, that's your first mistake, I think, Paul.
Yeah, but, you know, as an industry, you know, I think when you look at all industries, the gambling industry is really good at being quiet and really good at taking a kick in. You know, general press, general politicians, general naysayers against the industry do a very good job of kicking us. And you know, we seethe quietly and just get on with doing what we do best. That's probably a problem with the whole industry, not just Gibraltar industry. It's the worldwide industry.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. You know, we're an easy target for a kicking. But, you know, we've got to do that thing. And we've said it on this podcast a lot, or probably I have. When we fuck up, we've got to own our mistakes.
Yes.
That's simple. And you know, you're owning those two things and saying, it's a fair cop, Gov. We'll do your bidding. We'll do your unholy bidding.
Yeah. Yeah. And, when we go back to the grey list, and, you know, the worry from the operators here was, hold it, is the regulator suddenly going to start, you know, coming out and bullying us and actively looking to try and find cases and, you know, inventing stuff up like another well-known regulator often does during reviews. But the regulator here came straight away and said, no, that, you know, the processes work. The policies work of the regulator, you know, the act works. We're operating under that effectively. So we're not going to change what we're doing, but we'll probably just visit you all a bit more often. Great, fine. Don't mind it. Come in. Come and check on us. That's what your job's to do, and our job's to do it right.
Admire your optimism.
I'm a positive person.
That shines out of you, Paul. In slight, only a slight sidestep, but oh shit, the lid of my pen's gone. In a slight sidestep, because I mean Gibraltar, you touched on this a bit earlier. You know, it's a little peninsula. It's sticking out. It's a big rock. Monkeys doing their business. What's the given the? And I still can't quite believe this. I need to get over it. Given that Great Britain voted to leave the EU, despite that not being legally binding, we did it anyway. What is the future for Gibraltar? And this, I appreciate you. You're a CEO of a company. You're CEO of a gaming betting association. This can be entirely your personal opinion. You don't need to speak for any groups. But you're on the ground in Gibraltar. You speak to all the businesses. Is everybody there homicidal yet?
No, so it was, you know, I was there the day that obviously we Brexited, and I was woke up by my wife at 5 a.m. to say, you'll never guess what, you need to get up. Shortly followed by my then CEO sending me an email saying, you need to write a statement immediately on Gibraltar and what it means for you. To shortly be called in by the chief minister to say, we're not panicking, stay here. And it was the weirdest day I've ever had. And none of us understood what it meant. And then for the next 4 years, nobody understood what it really meant. So, you know, we were living in limbo land, and, you know, gambling companies are really good, as are, you know, most of the companies here, financial services, insurance, gambling companies. They all just got their advice and then put in place plan B. So, you know, we had to have an EU entity for gambling. Gibraltar was no longer the EU entity, so they went to get a license elsewhere in Malta. Most people did. And so people just got on with it. And as it's all played out, I think we were really pessimistic about what had happened. And everybody just planned for the worst. And actually, it's not been as bad for businesses as we expected, because we were able to mitigate it. I think on a personal level, it's a lot worse. You know, we have got a hard Brexit here, and we have got a hard border. And, you know, the UK doesn't see it. Or rather, Great Britain doesn't see it as much as we do on a daily basis. You know, it got to the stage where we can't even go across the border to go for lunch with our friends. You know, we had to book a hotel and have 100 euros in our pocket because that's the law on entering the EU from a non-EU country. You know, how long are you coming to stay? Where are you staying? And do you have enough money? And, you know, when you get that applied on a border, which you're used to walking across three or four times a day and getting your passport stamped, it gets to be a bit painful. Personally,
yeah, it does sound pretty crap, but you know, we were saying before we started recording that not a lot of attention was paid to that in government or by the public, and it's going to start hitting home hopefully sooner rather than later, so people can say, do you know what, maybe this was a bad idea.
Yeah, we all knew that here. We voted, I think, 99.98% to stay in the EU. And that would, you know, let's be honest, we were being selfish because we have an EU border that we need to cross daily. So, you know, the thought of being outside that was horrifying to us.
That's not selfish, Paul. That's just not stupid.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's not stupid, but you know, I come from the north of England, and if you live in the north of England, how often do you go across an EU border? Maybe once a year when you go on a holiday to Spain. So you're not going to see it. So you're going to say, well, it's got nothing to do with me. You forget that most of your food comes from the EU. You forget that most of your white goods come from China via the EU. And
why
people
would
just
you
didn't
set
realize.
Up any kind of a barrier between you and your main trading partner?
Well, because people didn't understand it. I think hindsight's a marvelous thing, but at the time you had absolutely politicians lying left, right and center. And they were never held to account because the whole vote should have been nulled on the fact that everybody was lying. But for some reason, some mad people continued with the farce. And we are where we are. We're Brexited. And we're dealing with the consequences. And there's probably no way back, although Gibraltar is trying to do our own deal, whereby we sit in the middle of the whole thing, which would be quite sweet if we get one.
Ooh, well, that sounds quite exciting.
Yeah, we're trying to get Schengen access through the back door. But we're going through the EU to do it. But, on a personal level, it'd be fantastic if we can get an agreement with the EU on a more fluid border. So that would be fantastic for Gibraltar if we can negotiate it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would think that would make a hell of a difference, not least to your shop.
To getting food in would be good. You know, it'd be nice to have some fresh milk again and nice to have some fresh meat and bacon and sausages and all the things we can't really get anymore. So
they're just trying to starve you into submission.
Yeah, they're not doing a very good job with myself. There's always...
You'll last longest.
Yeah. No, I think the macaques will last the longest. They will eventually just eat us.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't know if this is a stupid question, so I'll do what I usually do and just plow ahead with it. So with Gibraltar's current status of not being in the EU with a hard border, does that mean the Gibraltar gaming license as it stands is essentially the equivalent of a Great Britain license?
It's an international license. It's .com license, not EU. So you can provide services into any country that is licensed separately outside the EU. To be regulated market. So any market globally that's to be regulated, we can provide services to, but we can't do it. And, you know, could we provide services into the EU? There's probably an argument we could, but there's only two EU states that aren't licensed or regulated. So there's no point going into the EU anyway, because you can have a local license. Just like with the UK, right? You have to have a Gibraltar license and a UK license. If you want to operate in France, you have to have a Gibraltar license and a French license. So in reality, you know, with all of the European having now regulated a local level, it doesn't make much difference to Gibraltar because you're going to have a local license anyway.
For our international readers, what are the two European states, the two EU states that are not...
I knew you were going to ask me that, and I can't remember. I was asked this on a call yesterday, and for the life of me, I went blank, and I've just gone blank again.
It's going to be like Vatican City and Luxembourg or something, isn't it?
It's going to be
a pub quiz question in Gibraltar for the next 12 months.
It is. Which of the two that are not regulated? Because, of course, people look at it and go, oh, there's loads not regulated, but they are regulated because they've got government quangos running like lotteries and things. So they are still licensed and regulated, maybe just not for online gambling that we want to do. Yeah.
You would think that two people working in the gambling industry and experts would just be, oh, it's this one and this one. And I'm sitting there thinking, shit, which two is that?
I'll have to Google it afterwards.
It's a shame Fintan's not here. He'd know. Yeah.
He knows things. I'm not on the regulatory expert side. I'm not a lawyer.
By the time Fintan comes back from his holiday, the things that I will have said about him, he'll be like deified on the podcast. And he'll just come back and I'll just expect him to know everything. Yeah. I'm just going to keep saying it, but Fintan would know that.
You're presuming he actually listens to it while on holiday?
Yeah. It is ambitious, but I'm hoping he's listening because we're doing our sponsored mentions and stuff like that.
Of course.
Which, you know, actually I haven't brought up yet so far, but we have a sponsor.
I believe so.
No, and I'm, you know, certainly whenever I think about I think about all of the good in the world, and I think about trees and flowers, young children playing, laughing, frolicking, lambs in the springtime, sunset, the sunrise, over the sea, over the mountains, the birds trilling in the trees. And then I think about fulfilling all of your iGaming platform requirements. And I think of sporting tech, and it's that simple for me, Paul.
Well, you know, what can you say? They're obviously very capable and competent because they've sponsored this podcast. So well done to them.
I think that that is, it's a sign of quality.
Must be. Must be.
So, I don't think I have any other questions, Paul. You've just answered everything authoritatively.
I've just got mint sauce going through my head when you start talking about lambs frolicking. So
I am a big fan of lamb as well.
Oh, I had some. I was fortunate enough to be working in Dubai recently, and I know you just think gambling Dubai, etc. But you know the world is changing, and we're doing some education out there, and went to a place that did the most amazing like Arabic lamb chops that I've ever had, and I went back three nights in a row. They were stunning, but. And they came with mint sauce, which I thought was a very kind of British thing, but no, apparently not.
Hmm. I'm very lucky here. There's a butcher over in the next industrial estate. He's, as the crow flies, he's about 150 meters away from me, but it's quite a long walk.
Yeah, you have to walk around and, all the units.
So all the meat that I buy is let me put it this way. It's as ethical as meat buying can possibly be. It's all local to me. It's all from within 3 miles of me. It's all grass fed, and all out there frolicking and gambling in the, mountains around, well, mountains, big hills around Prestine. So it's friggin' delicious.
Yeah. You know, I know people want us to give up meat to save the world, but a lot of these animals wouldn't even be alive and have a chance of life without if we weren't going to eat them. So I'm all for eating them in order that they can have a nice life before, and especially if they're organic and get to frolic around the road down the hills.
That is just the most fantastically paradoxical argument. You wouldn't live if I didn't want to kill you.
Somebody actually quite famous said that, and I can't for the life of me remember. I was about to quote them at the end of it, but
too
smart for me.
I might have told the story on this podcast before. I can't remember. Like, so I have no issue with veganism. I have no issue with vegetarianism at all. When I was a puppy, when I was at sixth form college, so I'd have been about 17, 18. I remember my girlfriend at the time. Maz, she came over to me, and she was a vegetarian, and so was her best mate. And I was sitting there eating shepherd's pie. And they come over to go, "What are you eating?" I go, "Shepherd's pie." "What's in it?" "Well, lamb rather than, you know, shepherds."
Yeah. I thought you were going to say shepherds then.
They sit there and they start making barring noises. And I'm like, "Yep, that's what they sounded like." And then they're like, "Could you eat that if you had to catch and kill that lamb yourself? Could you kill a lamb?" I'm like, "Are you kidding me?
If it tastes this good,
lamb wouldn't stand a fucking chance."
Something that tastes this good? Hell yes.
What I wanted to say, and in subsequent years, I haven't seen either of them. Not quite since then, but not far off. But what I want to say to them in subsequent years is I hope that you know, you've never experienced this, but honestly, if you get hungry enough, you would too.
Pretty much anything.
But it's one of those, I mean, the luxury of diet is, well, it's a very Western thing. I read a fantastic book recently called The Big Fat Surprise. It's about misinformation in dietary guidance and where that misinformation has come from. It's a really fantastic book by an excellent journalist. It's a great piece of work. And in it, she talks about how some Inuit tribes, some African tribes, etc., their view of vegetables is that you'd only eat vegetables in a time of famine. Otherwise, there is no reason to eat vegetables. Vegetables are for the animals.
Ah, that's a good point.
But that these tribes also had, until Western diets reached them, almost zero heart disease, which is very interesting because, I mean, the book is essentially about the demonization of saturated fats. And their removal in a modern diet and what that removal has ultimately really meant. And so it's a fascinating read.
But anyway, I'll get it on my Kindle list.
No shit, Paul. It'll blow your mind.
Yeah, I like reading books like that when I'm stuck on planes because they're the grimmest place in the world to be stuck on a plane. It doesn't matter what class you are or what how much beer or wine they're going to put down your throat. You're stuck in a tin can with a 400 smelly people. So I like to read books that take my mind off, you know, that I've put myself in this situation at 40,000 feet with 400 people that I would never talk to in my entire life. So that would definitely go on my Kindle book list.
It's quite a dense book because she goes chronologically through the inception of these ideas, where these ideas came from. And it turns out from one nutritionist in North America. I was talking about this on the last episode of the podcast as well. But she deconstructs the major studies that have influenced US nutrition guidance, and it's mind blowing. It's bonkers.
I think it's like the diet industry is a huge industry globally, isn't it? But everybody knows diets don't work because they only work while you're on the diet, and then you go back to normal. So. And now there's loads of pills out there, fat burners, you know, the usual ones you get on your Google Gmail account. Every so often I go into spam and look at what they're trying to sell you. And there's thousands of these things out there. And you just sit there going, well, you know, there's only one way really to change your life, and that's to change the basis of how you eat and how you live. You know, going on a diet doesn't change anything except for the time you're on it. And to be honest, you probably do more harm than good. So I'm not a big fan of diets.
You have just reminded me, though. I've had a load of what they describe as male elongation emails recently.
Yes.
I need to forward those to Fintan.
There are some crackers on there, aren't there?
But I've lost, you know, following robustly, before I read this book, I was eating a high-fat diet anyway. But eating a high-fat diet, I have lost 12 inches plus off my waist in 18 months.
Wow. That's huge.
You know, and I feel good. And I've not gotten rid of health conditions, but in far less pain, etc. You know, it's like there are definitely some bonuses in there. I mean, we'll see if I die younger, but I'm willing to be a guinea pig in this particular lab.
And to be honest, if you die younger, you won't know anything about it anyway.
It's true.
So, you know, what's to worry about?
I've often thought that capital punishment, for example, it depends too much on the existence of an afterlife to really be much of a deterrent.
Yeah.
Because, if you're killed for a crime, you can't be punished for it anymore.
No, you don't.
But if somebody took a bit of time to get to know you, to really find out what gets under your skin... So say, for example, I don't know, say you orchestrated a bank robbery in which 7 people died, which, you know, would make you a pretty shitty person. And then somebody found out that your greatest fear was chihuahuas. Then why not just put you amongst chihuahuas every day until we develop a new fear and then we'll build on that? Why don't we just make your life absolute hell and keep you alive for as long as we can?
Isn't that called marriage?
the one
person who knows you better than anyone else is your life partner, and they are the one person that can make your life miserable if they choose, and you can do the same to them because you know each other inside out.
You say that, right? But when yeah. I was married, I was married for six years, 7 years, I don't know, and in the last year. In the last year we were together, I think it was the last Christmas. No, actually, it was my birthday, I think. It was the birthday, like, 6 months before we split up. And it was, I'm either a really easy person to buy for or a really difficult person to buy for. But in this particular year, I was an easy person to buy for. The Dark Knight had just come out on DVD. Oh,
brilliant.
Which just makes me a super easy person to buy for. It's like, just get me that, I'm happy. So instead, I got a cheap plastic bird feeder and some nuts. And nobody got me The Dark Knight on DVD. You know, you say they know you better than anybody else. Well, maybe.
Well, no, maybe not. Clearly not happy with you, hence why you got the bird feeder.
Wow.
Yeah. And maybe she thought you had a phobia of birds. Who knows?
Ooh, yeah.
Or
punishment.
Maybe she was hinting that you were spending too much time around birds, but maybe of a different variety.
Maybe
who knows?
She just wanted me to go and fuck myself.
That definitely also is one of those thoughts.
Highly, highly possible. Yeah. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today and talking Gibraltar. If you don't mind, we'll contact you again next time something goes horribly wrong on your rock, so to
or
speak.
Something goes really well. Let's be positive.
No, totally that as well. It's just, last episode we had Sharon and Roz from Asia Gaming Brief on.
Yeah.
And we finished the conversation. I said, we'll see you next time something terrible happens in Asia. And they were both like, next week then.
I'll see about the ASEAN conference in about 2 weeks' time. So should all be good.
Yeah, I've not been. I've heard it's very good. Have you been?
Yeah. So I went 3 years ago. So going out to Manila to meet up with the old guard out there. It should be interesting. It's a good chance to reconnect with people that, let's be honest, we've all lost contact with for a long time.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, some people you probably don't want to. I mean, we're literally going to get there really excited. You're going to start meeting people and go, oh, I never liked you anyway.
Yeah. Oh, you're still a twat. That's good to know.
Nothing changes.
But Paul, thank you for your time. Thank you for joining us. And we'll see you again, hopefully.
Yeah, cheers. Really appreciate it.